everyone. It's good to be back and welcome to this episode of Ian Chelf's ABCs of Somerset, looking today at the letters I and J. And I is for Ilminster, I-L-M-I-N-S-T-E-R, Ilminster, which is nowadays a fairly small town, almost a big village. It's right down in the south of the county, not very far away from the border with Dorset. And today, it's only about 5,000-6,000 people that live there. So it's often a bit of a surprise when people learn that it was once one of the four largest towns in the whole county of Somerset. And its past is very much tied up with Mucholney Abbey, which is a great monastic foundation, we think founded by King Ine of Wessex, the king of the West Saxons, sometime in the 7th century. We've got various dates from the ends of the 600s, early 700s. And there is a mention that one of the things that the new abbey was endowed with was the land that became the town of Ilminster. When monarchs and noblemen and other wealthy enough people founded monastic or religious foundations, they normally endowed them with things to provide a source of income, land, rights to use mills, things like that. And in the case of Ilminster, they were given land alongside a river called the River Isle, where was built a Minster church dedicated to St. Mary, which with many alterations is still the parish church of Ilminster today. And it gives rise to the town. Ilminster means the Minster church on the River Isle. You will look in vain on maps nowadays for the River Isle because it's undergone a name change. It's now called the River Yeo, one of several Yeos in the Somerset area, confusingly enough. But founded it was, and it very much prospered. We know, for example, at the time of the Domesday Book, it already had a market and no fewer than three mills, probably milling corn, but we can't be certain, all of which were under the control of Mucholney Abbey. There was also, by the early Middle Ages, an annual fair, a two-day fair. We get that first mentioned in 1280, but the mentioning says that it was actually a very ancient tradition even then. So when that started, we can't be absolutely sure. But it grew and grew and grew and became very, very successful indeed, particularly, like a lot of Somerset towns, notable for the manufacture of cloth. Funnily enough, it never became a borough. You would expect it to be, but the abbey at Mucholney very much kept it all under its own control. So they took all the rents and all the dues from the town. It had no kind of local democracy. The church wardens at St. Mary's were very much the agents of the monks and the abbot at Mucholney. So everything went along very successfully. It grew to be a big town until that big incidents in Somerset and indeed English history, which was the Reformation and the dissolution of the monasteries. And Mucholney Abbey was taken by the crown and sold off, and the abbey and all of its lands, including Ilminster, were purchased initially by a family called the Seymours, the Seymour family of Queen Jane Seymour, wife of Henry VIII, as it happens, who became Dukes of Somerset, although they eventually sold it on to a family called the Speke family, who were there for much longer. They were what I suppose we would now call nouveau riche. You know, they'd actually earned their money doing things rather than inherited it, which nowadays would be a source of great pride. But in those days, it was a sort of slightly, these are sort of upstart type people. But the Speke family are very, very wealthy and were able to add Ilminster to what I suppose now we would call their property portfolio. And when the era in the 18th century of turnpike roads came along, then Ilminster found itself having a sort of second wind, if you like. It found a new prosperity because it happened to be on the turnpike road from London to Exeter. Now, turnpike trusts were effectively companies that laid out roads, charged people tolls to use them. They would have gates where you stopped to pay your toll. And sometimes people would try and leap over those gates. So a rather gruesome system was devised of having great big sharpened metal spikes on the top, which when the gate wasn't attended could be turned into an upwards position to stop people leaping over on horseback. And from this comes the name turnpike, a pike that could be turned upwards. Anyway, the turnpike trusts from building this road from London to Exeter went in for what turnpike trusts often did. They built newer roads that avoided difficult stretches. They might go round a hill, or in the case of Ilminster, they avoided the congested marketplace and built or took over a new road along the northern edge of town, along West Street, and a street called the Butts, which is probably where the men of Ilminster originally practiced their archery. There was a law dating back to the 13th century which required all native-born Englishmen to practice their archery after church every Sunday. So many towns have a road called the Butts. And Butts is a word for a sort of archery area. So the Turnpike Trust improved the Butts and West Street, and they sort of shifted the focus of the town north to there. In fact, part of that road became the present-day High Street. So the old town to the south was somewhat bypassed, although it's not very far away. And a whole series of new coaching inns grew up, one of which is very famously the George Inn, sometimes called the George Hotel, whose appointment with history was when the young princess, later Queen Victoria, stayed there with her parents when they were travelling to their favourite seaside resort of Sidmouth in Devonshire. Probably around the same time, the Market House was built. If you go into the Market Square now in Ilminster, there's a lovely open but covered, open at the sides, market hall called the Market House on a series of stone pillars. It was once part of a much bigger series of covered areas called the Shambles, but this is the only part that that now survives. And it around there is a really interesting part of the town to explore. If you go a little way to the west, you'll find St. Mary's Church, which I said dates right the way back to the founding of Ilminster. But today, an awful lot of what you see dates from the 15th century. So it's later, but still very old. It's on a hill. And that, combined with the fact that the churchyard has been filled up in several levels over the years, gives it a very imposing position. And if you go around the back of it on the north side, there's a little cluster of lovely buildings, the old grammar school, which later became the girls' school, which one author, not too fancifully actually, said made it look like a small version of a cathedral close, which is absolutely and entirely fair there. It's a lovely little collection of buildings. And if you go inside the church, the interior contains a tomb with a brass of a man called William Wadham, who lived locally, and other members of his family. A later one, Nicholas Wadham and his wife Dorothy, they were the founders of a college in Oxford, which is still there, still going today, called Wadham College. So another little connection that we have with Somerset, and a very, very pleasant town to go around and to explore. Now, remember the Speke family that I mentioned? One of them, one fateful day in the year 1685, shook hands in that marketplace with a young man called James Scott, who also happened to be the Duke of Monmouth. At the time, he was probably showing gratitude and a sense of welcome and perhaps hoping for a slightly different future. But that handshake was to cost him his life. And that, as we leave I is for Ilminster, brings us on to a story that we will tell in our next letter, letter J. So that brings us on to the letter J. And J has given me something of a problem, because as far as I'm aware, there is not anywhere in the whole of the county of Somerset anywhere beginning with J. Now, having said that, I will probably now be inundated with messages from people saying there is somewhere that I've forgotten, and it'll probably be somewhere obvious. But assuming that there is not, J gives me the chance to talk about one of the most important and, in fact, one of the most tragic episodes in England's history. That's to say, the Monmouth Rebellion. So J is for James the First Duke of Monmouth, who was one of the very many illegitimate children of King Charles II. Charles II, son of Charles I, was living in exile in 1648. His father had effectively lost the English Civil War. He was a prisoner. He was being put on trial. And in January of 1649, he was actually executed for high treason on the balcony of Whitehall Palace. As you might expect, most of the rest of his family had fled into exile in either France or the Netherlands. And Charles, who was still technically the Prince of Wales, had gone to the Netherlands, to The Hague. And it was there that his eye was caught by another exile, a young lady by the name of Lucy Walter, who'd come originally from West Wales. And it said she was the first of many girls that caught his eye. And he fathered a child with her who was given the name James. And James, while England was a Commonwealth or Republic, lived in exile, mostly in the Netherlands, in Rotterdam, in Schiedam, in The Hague. But eventually, after many years of Republican rule, when Lord Protector Oliver Cromwell died, he was succeeded very briefly by his son, Richard Cromwell. That really didn't work out. And so the government of the day decided to restore the monarchy, give Charles Junior, Charles Prince of Wales, the title, King Charles II, and allow him to come back under a number of very strict conditions, one of which was that he would confirm his Protestant faith, even though there have always been suspicions that he was secretly a Catholic. And some people believe he converted officially to Catholicism on his deathbed in 1685. That's one of those things we shall never know. But Charles and all his royal entourage, including his son James, came back to England. Back in England, James married, actually not very long after his 14th birthday. It seems a bizarre thing to us, but that's exactly what did happen. He married a lady called Anne Scott, who was from Dundee. She was of the family of the Dukes of Buccleuch. And actually, it was through her that he gained not only his surname, he became James Scott, but also earned the title of the Duke of Buccleuch. He then had a very successful period as a military commander in both the Royal Navy and on land. England was going through one of its very rare periods, actually almost unique, I would say, of not getting on with the Netherlands. The Dutch have, throughout much of history, been our solid and good allies. But there was one period in the 1650s, 1660s, 1670s, when there were a series of three wars between the Netherlands and England. Generally, the English tend to be quite good at winning their wars, albeit often with very great help from our allies. Success in the Anglo-Dutch Wars repeatedly swung back and forth between England and the Netherlands. As one of my Dutch friends is never reticent about reminding me, the Dutch managed to mount a daring raid on the English fleet while it was moored up in the Royal Dockyard at Chatham. They managed to sail right the way up the River Medway and fire or burn much of the English fleet and tow away the Royal Navy's flagship as a trophy back to the Netherlands. It was something that was very scarcely achieved throughout English history. But all the way through this, on land and on sea, James, who had also now gained the title of Duke of Monmouth and governor of Kingston upon Hull, a very important town on the east coast for military connections and trading connections later with the Low Countries, James really did manage to distinguish himself. So this title of Duke of Monmouth was a great honour for him, but he had very much earned it. Well, as the years went on, this question of the royal succession mattered, because King Charles II, although he had fathered many children other than the Duke of Monmouth, had not managed to father any with his actual wife, Queen Catherine, who was a Portuguese princess. So in legal terms, his only successor was his younger brother, James, Duke of York. Now, James, just like James, Duke of Monmouth, had also managed to get a great reputation commanding the Navy. During the Anglo-Dutch Wars, it was he who captured the important Dutch colony of New Amsterdam in North America. And New Amsterdam was renamed New York in his honour, because James was Duke of York. But the problem was, James was openly a Roman Catholic. He had two daughters, who had both been brought up at his brother Charles's insistence as Protestants, and they were married to important Protestant families in Europe. His younger daughter Anne was married to George of Denmark, and his older daughter Mary was married to none other than William, Prince of Orange. But James himself insisted that he would keep his Catholic faith. And when his brother Charles did eventually die in February of 1685, James became King James II of England and James VII of Scotland. And this had happened. We had once again a Roman Catholic monarch. There was a lot of disquiet about this, but a lot of people thought it was okay because James had just these two daughters who were both very firmly Protestants, and therefore the Protestant succession was assured. But, and it was a very big but, James then took a second wife after the loss of his first wife, Anne Hyde. He married a lady called Mary of Modena, and she gave birth to a son, James Edward Stuart, who James now declared, buoyed on by the fact that he was now king, would become the Catholic King of England. Well, this started all sorts of discussions about whether or not we should stick with this official and legal process. There had even, while Charles II was alive, been plots against him, including an abortive plan called the Rye House Plot to get rid of both Charles and his younger brother, the Duke of York. How successful that would have been, no, what historians still argue about. And in fact, the plotters weren't sure whether they wanted to establish a Protestant republic like the Netherlands or whether or not they'd put a Protestant on the throne. But it didn't get very far. But enter at this point our J for James, James the Duke of Monmouth. He was persuaded by Protestant forces in England and indeed on the continent to try to capture the English throne. He himself had been brought up as a Protestant. There were those who claimed that his father had actually legally been married to Lucy Walters. It's almost certainly not the case. But he was persuaded to land a force in England and take the throne. And that is pretty much exactly what he did or tried to do. In June of 1685, he landed at Lyme Regis in Dorset, and he was at first very warmly received by the men of the West Country. It was not a Catholic stronghold at all. They were allegedly not friends of King James. And as a result, initially men flocked to him as he marched northwards from Lyme up through Axminster and headed for Taunton, where he was given an absolutely rapturous welcome there. He was feted by young girls from the local dame school. He stayed in the house of Captain John Hucker. If you go to Taunton today, opposite what was the County Hotel, Hucker's house was over there. And buoyed on by this, they headed on to Glastonbury, where they apparently got absolutely soaked to the skin in a terrible thunderstorm there. They had to dry their equipment out in the Abbey grounds. They were intending to take Bristol. And if you think Bristol then as now was the sort of gateway to the west of England. But the number of people flocking to his aid was not quite as great as the young Duke of Monmouth had been led to expect. This has happened in many, many cases in English and indeed Scottish history. People kept saying, it'll be all right, more people will come to you, and they didn't. So rather than go to Bristol himself, they went up through Pensford and then to Keynsham. They got their first serious attack there at Keynsham between Bristol and Bath. They didn't succeed in getting Bath to go to their cause either, though, to be fair, royalist forces from London were now pouring in on the other side, and they withdrew to a place called Norton St. Philip, which is one of the great points of, you know, where you get all these signs that say Queen Elizabeth I slept here or King Henry VIII slept here. You get that in the West Country with the Duke of Monmouth as well, and that was one of the places that he actually overnighted, at Norton St. Philip. It's a beautiful village worth visiting anyway. They headed south to Frome and Shepton Mallet, and then on to Wells, where they did a considerable amount of damage. If you go to Wells, the west front of Wells Cathedral is one of the great sights of England. But I'm afraid his rather ragtag West Country army did immense damage using the west front as target practice. Sometimes there are accounts of this Monmouth rebellion which call it the Pitchfork Rebellion, which is a bit unfortunate, really, because it does imply that it wasn't a serious military force, that it was just farmers, dare I say, yokels from the west of England armed only with pitchforks. And that is emphatically not the case. It was not as well-drilled an army as the royalist one, but nor were they just armed with pitchforks. And the west front of Wells Cathedral, for centuries afterwards, showed that they were equipped with a fair amount of firepower. But the royalists in London had been very, very concerned about this. And James II sent an army under Viscount Feversham, which went out to initially keep an eye on the rebels. But eventually the two forces did come together. And it happened on the Somerset Levels in a very flat and desolate and therefore windswept area near a village called Weston Zoyland. Now, like much of the Somerset Levels, that area is all artificially drained. And there are a number of drainage ditches, which in Somerset we call reens. It's spelled R-H-Y-N-E-S, but pronounced reens. In the east of England, they're often referred to as dikes. That's a term that I've heard in Lincolnshire. But in Somerset, we call drainage ditches reens. And one of those was to have a very considerable effect on the battle. See, the Duke had been aiming to avoid Bristol and go up through Axbridge, which we've already talked about, and then up to Gloucester. But while they were camped near Weston Zoyland, the Duke and some of his advisors climbed to the top of St. Mary's Church up in the town of Bridgewater. And through a telescope, they were able to, they thought, observe royalist movements. And they thought the royalist army was rather smaller than it was. And this led to them planning a surprise attack. So in the very early hours of the 6th of July, they started out from their camp near Weston Zoyland with the intention of attacking Faversham's forces directly. What they didn't know was that in the way was one of these drainage ditches, one of these drainage ditches called the Bussex Reen. And they headed over to attack the royalists. Someone, it's not known who, fired a shot which alerted the sleeping royalist forces. And then the Duke of Monmouth's army stumbled into this reen, which wasn't where they thought it was. The rebels panicked and the line broke and they fled back in the direction of Bridgewater. But some of them then fell into this reen. Some of them were then picked off by the royalists. And it was something of a rout. The Duke himself escaped, but many, many others bogged down in the partially drained fields, were rounded up or hacked down where they were. We have an account from the church warden of Weston Zoyland Church. If you go to this church now, inside there is a really detailed and not very much visited display about the history of the battle, and an account by the church warden that he thought the battle saw about 300 rebels killed and 500 prisoners were taken and were crammed into the church. At least five of them died in the church itself of their wounds, but there was then summary justice meted out by a man who history recalls as Judge Jeffreys, presiding over what were called the Bloody Assizes. All of the commanders in each of the county divisions, what were called hundreds, were ordered by the king's forces to compile lists of all men of the village who'd been absent during the rebellion. All the constables had to make up these lists, and Judge George Jeffreys presided over these assizes, mostly in Taunton and in Bristol, but in a few other places as well, Winchester and Salisbury, Exeter, Wells, Dorchester. There are a few other places as far north as Droitwich in Worcestershire, which claim to have had assizes presided over by Judge Jeffreys. They're probably not the case. We think it's just at Winchester, Salisbury, Dorchester, Exeter, Taunton, Wells, and Bristol. And there was very little justice, very little leniency, I should say, handed out to these people. At Taunton, over 500 people were tried. 350 of them were hanged, drawn, and quartered in these market towns. The others were transported for penal servitude to the West Indies, effectually turned into slaves. And that was the end of the Monmouth Rebellion. Although Monmouth himself had escaped the battle, he didn't actually managed to escape altogether. A reward of £5,000 was put out for his capture, and he was eventually found in Hampshire near the town of Ringwood, supposedly in a field of peas. But that might just be a legend that was put up to sort of ridicule him. We have an account from what's called Tate's Edinburgh Magazine about how he was captured there, but it might have been embroidered in order to humiliate him even more. But whatever happens, he did eventually get captured, and he was taken off ultimately with a number of stops on the way. He was eventually taken off to London. And he was beheaded on the 15th of July, 1685, not in the Tower of London, as many people will often claim, but outside the Tower on Tower Hill. The Bishop of Bath and Wells had actually attended to him, but he withheld the Eucharist because the Duke refused to confess to what he'd done being unlawful. Some say it took between 5 and 8 blows to sever the head from his body. Again, there are different accounts of this, but he was buried in the church of St. Peter ad Vincula, St. Peter in Chains, which is the church you find today inside the Tower of London. And he was forfeited of all of his titles. Many, many years later, the titles were, or some of the titles were restored to his grandson Francis Scott, who became the second Duke of Buccleuch. There is a legend that after the beheading of the Duke of Monmouth, they realized they didn't have a portrait of him, and he was, after all, the late king's son. So they exhumed his body, stitched the head back on, sat for it to be painted. It's a great story to tell if a certain bloodthirsty one. It's probably not true. There is a portrait of him in the National Portrait Gallery, but that we think does date from before his death anyway. But legends do tend to take up all over the place. There's also a story that he escaped and went off to France, where he was hidden as a prisoner, and that he was the inspiration for the legend of the man in the iron mask. But again, that's extremely unlikely. He probably did, I'm afraid, meet his end on Tower Hill and saw the men of the West Country being ultimately forced to pay a very high price themselves for siding with this rebel. The irony of all this is that eventually King James II did have to flee for his own life. His Catholicism and his determination to pass on to his new son a Catholic throne led ultimately to his daughter, Mary, and son-in-law, Prince William of Orange, being persuaded to come to England. They also came to the Southwest. They landed at Brixham in Devonshire, where the Prince William of Orange actually tried in broken English to explain to the townsfolk of Brixham, "I have come for your goods, all of your goods." And it seems very unfair to poke fun at his misunderstood English in that he'd come forth to make good things for them, not to take away all their goods, given that the English are not renowned the world over for their command of foreign languages. So eventually he did, in fact, cause James to flee. There wasn't even a serious battle in that. There was a skirmish in Reading High Street and another one on Hounslow Heath, not far from where Heathrow Airport now is. But James fled off to exile in France, and the Protestant future of England and indeed Scotland was eventually assured, with Princess Mary becoming Queen Mary II. The only time we've had a joint monarchy, Mary II and William III, who became joint monarchs. But of course, they had no children, and the royal succession after they both died passed on to James II's younger daughter, Anne, who, despite 17 pregnancies, none of her children survived beyond the age of 9. And eventually there were thoughts of bringing the Stuarts back, two serious attempts in 1715 and 1745 to bring James Edward Stuart and then Charles, Bonnie Prince Charlie, back to the throne, because he had much support in Scotland. But neither of them was ultimately successful, although the 1745 rebellion very nearly was. And after Queen Anne's death, the Protestant Parliament and Government of England had to go searching all the way through the royal houses of Europe to anyone that was vaguely related and was Protestant. And the closest they could find was the 50th in line, Sophia, the Electress of Hanover in Germany, and her son. She died before Queen Anne, only shortly before, and her son, George, became King George I of Great Britain, as it then was, and Prince of Hanover. But we are getting rather beyond ourselves here. So this attempt to get the Protestant future of England assured under the Duke of Monmouth didn't succeed, but it had a terribly high death toll here in Somerset and in the west of England generally. And that is my way of doing J is for James, the Duke of Monmouth.